Is there a happy solution to the problem of evil? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, Emeritus Professor of Old Testament in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. I'm your host and study guide author. Theme for our discussion this quarter is God's love and justice, and our particular lesson for this week is the problem of evil. Now let's come back to the leading question and say, is there a happy solution to the problem of evil? Or is there just a solution?
Well, like with most things in life, I think we expect immediate solutions to problems that had a long time to be created. And I think that when it comes to the problem of evil, this is a long-term problem.
Yeah.
And the solution is probably not going to be immediate and painless.
And we would also have to define the word evil and the extent. Not only is it a long-term problem, but it's very widespread and broad, and the effects of it. Are we talking about natural evil? Are we talking about moral evil? Are we talking about biological evil? And at what level are all of accidental? You know, if I trip and fall, or I miss my foot on a ladder and I fall and break my leg, is that evil? Is pain evil? I mean, there's a lot of questions to that too, right?
Yeah. I think that I worked this one through and listened here, and I said I think there are at least four partial solutions. Okay? Now, my own personal experience, and I was a very sensitive youngster, but there were two stories in the Bible that really troubled me. One was Uzzah, and the reason it's troubling, I mean, there's all kinds of bodies all over the place in the Old Testament that aren't troubling, but it looked like he was just trying to be nice. And he reached out, and the Lord got him. And the other story, which is similar to that, is, well, it's not similar, but it's the story of the two she-bears that came out of the woods. And Elisha cursed them, and the two she-bears came out and mauled 42 of them. Now, as a result of these two stories together, when I was growing up, I learned to be very careful when dealing with sacred objects or people. The result was a very impoverished prayer life. But just as the problem arose from two Old Testament stories, the solution came from two other Old Testament stories that helped me realize that God's friends are skeptics. Abraham's conversation with God over Sodom and Moses' conversation with God over the fate of Israel. Now, we've already looked at the story of Genesis 18 and how Abraham came out and asserted that the judge of all the earth must do right. That's one story. But when I got to the story of Israel's rebellion at Sinai, the second story fell into place. Here is the biblical narrative from Exodus 32, and it had to do with Israel's rebellion. The Lord said to Moses, "Go down at once. Your people whom you have brought up out of the land of Egypt have acted perversely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I commanded them. And they have cast for themselves an image of a calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.' The Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, how stiff-necked they are. Now let me alone so that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation.' But Moses implored the Lord his God and said, 'O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a great and mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, "It was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth"? Turn from your fierce wrath. Change your mind and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, how you swore to them by your own self, saying to them, 'I will multiply your descendants like the stars of heaven.'" Not getting my page turned here at the right time. "Stars of heaven. All this land I have promised them I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever." And the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he planned to bring on them. This blew me away. Ellen White interprets this as that the Lord deliberately played with Moses. He says, "I'll make of you a great nation." He forced Moses to take his stand with God's people. And I think that's very important. Now, does this very personal story resonate at all with your experience or with other believers of your acquaintance? For me, I was now liberated to confront the God of the universe.
Alden, help me be a little bit more specific. How did that story liberate you?
Well, going back to Uzzah and the two she-bears, those two stories together, if you step out of line, the Lord's going to get you. You're impolite to the prophet, the bears will get you. And what this did was make my prayer life very tame, because I didn't want to get in trouble, see.
Hmm.
But once I got the other part of the story here, the partial solution was when Abraham argued with God and when Moses argued with God. See, that was an indication that I had been far too worried about that particular issue, and that there was a good God who would respond to his people and
that was willing to be challenged, that was willing to engage in that kind of in that back and forth with his people.
Yeah.
Did that give you insight into those stories, though?
What it did was to help balance out the influence of those stories. I still don't like Uzzah.
Yeah, that one's a tough one.
And in fact, David was angry too. Yeah.
What do we have a sense about why Uzzah was struck?
Well,
I mean, I think I've read the passages that might lead to it, but weren't there strict instructions with the handling of the ark?
Oh, yeah.
It has acacia poles through golden rings, only to be carried, always carried, never put on a cart, always carried by hand, right?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a whole paper on needed to put the poles through the right rings, and I wrote a whole paper on it in graduate school, and yet as I submitted the paper— my fingers dripping still with the ink, I was unsatisfied with what I had written.
Right.
and I struggle with it still. Even though I feel like I locked it up tight in that paper, it's unsatisfying. You know, Greg Boyd, Crucifixion of the Warrior God, he comes back to this idea of when we look at these stories through the lens of Christ, we either understand them or at least we make space that there's more there that we're missing. And that has to be one of those stories where I say, through the lens of Christ, there has to be a piece of this that I'm missing, because I get it. They didn't put the poles through the rings and he put his hand, I get it. There's got to be more there.
Well, one of the explanations that I have, and it's just a guess because the story is there and Uzzah got it, see. But was Uzzah, he was in the home and grew up. He should have known better, see. But there is a sense that, and this is kind of a crazy story, if you were on campus and really attracted by a girl, you were hoping someday she'd drop her books so that you could reach out and help her. See, get those books. I don't know whether there was something like that where Uzzah was looking for the opportunity to touch the ark. I don't know.
His role, though, as one of the leaders of Israel, as a Levite, right, as a priest— that meant that his role was to know how to handle those things. He was the example of how to handle the sacred.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I guess I have a heart of compassion for Uzzah. I think of the story in Exodus 4 of Moses, a bridegroom of blood, the circumcision on the way. And I think of Moses experiencing a bit of an uncomfortable experience in that story. And yet he lives on the other side of it. And I wonder, could there have been a uncomfortable lesson for Uzzah, but he's alive on the other side of it?
Well, and I have always wondered that. Are all of those who perished in the flood lost forever? Are all of those who perished in Sodom and Gomorrah lost forever? We get the sense with Sodom and Gomorrah that the answer is yes. With the flood, all the thoughts of men's heart was only evil continually, but God worked with Noah. Was it possible that there were more? Does God allow lives to be taken temporarily that isn't eternal?
You take all the disasters we've had just in recent days, natural disasters. Where is providence? And we'll be coming to that question.
Yeah.
How do you deal with providence in a chaotic world like we've got today? But I want to go to another partial solution, and I've entitled it Misery Loves Company. The official study guide helps us to compile a fairly long list of believers who had tussle with the theodicy question, and introduces a term that is useful as a heading, the skeptical theist. How can a good God be master of a world where there is so much discord and pain? The official study guide defines a skeptical theist as follows. The skeptical theist is one who believes God has good reasons for acting as he does, but given our limited knowledge, we should not expect to be in a position to know just what those reasons are. The skeptical theist is skeptical regarding the human capacity to be aware or to understand fully God's reasons relative to the evil in the world. Now, all of my skeptic examples, except one, are from the Old Testament. But the one from the New Testament is crucial. Jesus' cry from the cross, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" recorded in two of the Gospels, Matthew 27 and Mark 15. It must be noted that Jesus is quoting Psalm 22 from the Old Testament. It is as if Jesus' death was and is the solution to the theodicy question. So here's the rest of my list. Some of the passages are tangential, but they are part of the picture. Job 30:26. But when I looked for good, evil came, and when I waited for light, darkness came. Then Job 38:2. Why do you talk so much when you know so little? Psalm 10:1. Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Psalm 73, truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant. I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Jeremiah 12:1, you will be in the right, O Lord, when I lay charges against you, but let me put my case to you. Why does the way of the guilty prosper? Why do all who are treacherous thrive? Jeremiah 13, do you know why your clothes were torn off and you were abused? It was because of your terrible sins. This verse doesn't really belong on the list, but it does not, for it does not blame God, but humans for our dilemma. And then Habakkuk 1, O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not listen, or cry to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see wrongdoing and look at trouble? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law becomes slack and justice never prevails. The wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, judgment becomes perverted. And then there's Malachi 4:17. You have wearied the Lord with your words, yet you say, how have we wearied him? By saying all who do evil are good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights them, or saying, where is the God of justice? And then finally, the fourth one, and then we'll have to close, is the free will defense, and we'll come back to this. When you put together the free will argument and the skeptical theist, I think you have something there that will make it possible for us to begin to look at the problem of evil. So, time is up. Thank you to Brant and to Albert and our program engineer, Kristen Byerly. Thank you for listening. For the good word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.